And this is Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio News. The story of how slavery came to an end is well documented in American history. The Civil War era is told through newspaper accounts, books, letters, memoirs. But what about pictures? The earliest photographs appeared in the mid-1800s, and according to our next guest, they had immediate effect on American culture and on the struggle over slavery. Matthew Fox Amato teaches history at the University of Idaho. Oxford University Press has just published his book. It is called Exposing Slavery, Photography, Human Bondage, and the Birth of Modern Visual Politics in America. And he joins us today from Moscow.
Welcome. Yes, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. The first thing I need to say is that this book is stunning, the presentation. You should be very happy in how it was published, and these photographs, these images, just jump from the page.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, and I should add, Oxford did a fantastic job in producing this book, and yeah, it's a book that is full of images in no small way, because I'm kind of part of a trend within history that is trying to actually understand how images aren't just illustrations of history, but how images shaped history. And I'm really glad that that comes through when you read it.
To be sure, there are thousands of books on the Civil War. How is yours different?
Well, I think, as I was just mentioning, historians for the longest time have, when they've looked at evidence, looked at words to support their arguments and treated images as illustrations of something that they were basically finding elsewhere, whether it was letters or diaries or Lincoln speeches. What I'm trying to do is actually understand how photography, a technology and a visual technology, emerged in the mid-19th century and did more than just reflect the times, but actually actively shape the times. And so what I do in my book is, photography is born in 1839 in France and Britain pretty much simultaneously, and it comes quickly to America's shores. And what I do, and what is so striking about this moment, is you can see how historical actors from across the political spectrum take up this medium and use it for different political and moral purposes. So you see slaveholders from the 1840s onwards begin bringing enslaved people to photographic studios to get their portraits made. You see abolitionists take up the medium to both try and sway the masses, but also build their social movement. You even see enslaved people who, of course, are dramatically poor as a social class, yet, as we know now, some enslaved people had small amounts of cash, and they, too, are going to photograph studios to get their portraits made. And so this is a kind of cultural dynamic that really hasn't been looked at in full yet.
And so you say that slave owners or abolitionists depicted slaves in certain ways. Southerners, how did they appear in photographs? What did they look like?
In a variety of ways. For the most part, you see enslaved people posing in studio portraits. They're posing alone sometimes. Sometimes you see enslaved women holding white children. Sometimes you see enslaved people holding the tools of their trade, holding wool carders, there's one photograph of Hector, who was an enslaved man in Georgia, and Hector was a boatman. One of his tasks was to basically go get the mail for his enslaver, and Hector poses with the oar from the boat. So those are the primary ways in which enslaved people are being photographed. And then you see slaveholders using those photographs in different ways, using them explicitly for propaganda purposes, using them on fugitive want ads to help catch fugitives. So those are a few different ways that they're showing up in the ways the photographs are being used.
So what surprised you? What images did you see that maybe you hadn't expected to see?
Yeah, that Hector image was one of them. And I think it was really remarkable to begin to understand Hector's backstory and how that related to the photograph. Another one that I had seen but didn't know the full story of yet was a photograph of Dolly. Dolly was enslaved by the Manigault family, who they're kind of aristocratic, low country family in South Carolina and Georgia. And Dolly, two photographs of Dolly at least, are pasted onto fugitive want ads when she basically escapes during the Civil War. And I had seen the photograph before, and I had seen the want ad before, but what was really interesting was to actually look at the slaveholders' private letters talking about Dolly when she left. And one of the things that the slaveholder, his name is Louis Manigault, one of the things that Louis Manigault says when Dolly bolts is that he says the likeness is very important in such cases because she left with a lot of clothing. So one of the things that he's thinking about when she runs away is that the photograph is going to help people identify her face, even if she's going to change her clothing. And so that was really remarkable to me to understand how, and this is in the, this is in 1863. This is in the third full decade of photography, to understand how slaveholders had already begun thinking about how we can use photography for surveillance purposes. He was really fixated on how the photograph was going to be an effective way to catch her.
We're speaking with Matthew Fox-Amato, an assistant professor of history at the University of Idaho. Well, the title of your book is called Exposing Slavery, certainly a multi-tiered meaning there. How and where did the public in those times see these photos?
A variety of ways, and it depends on which social group we're talking about. If you think about these studio portraits of enslaved people that slaveholders are making, they're primarily seeing those photos in people's homes and in semi-public places like offices. So, for example, I write about one slaveholder named Edward Pringle, who's from a Charleston family, but he moves to San Francisco in the 1850s to practice law. And one day, Edward Pringle writes home to his mom back in Charleston, and he says, "Mom, thanks so much for sending me your photograph. I feel like I can see you through the photograph." And then he goes on, he says, "And thanks especially for sending me the photograph of Mac." And Mac was an enslaved butler in the Pringles' Charleston townhome. Edward Pringle talks about, he goes on for a full paragraph, and he talks about how he keeps Mac's photograph in his office in San Francisco for everyone to look at when they come in. He says, "What a remarkable example of the institution this is." And he's talking about slavery there. He talks about how he thinks Mac is better dressed than anyone in California. He also interestingly says he laughs at Mac. He says, I've laughed over him a dozen times. So that's a kind of example of, you know, if you're a client of Edward J. Pringle, you actually walk into his office and see a photograph, and he's going to tell you this photograph is a representation of slavery.
Can we assume that African-Americans were passive subjects, or were some of them willing participants in these photos?
That is a really tricky question, and unfortunately, I don't have strong evidence about what it was like, what the kind of conditions of producing the photographs were like. I will say that African Americans, both enslaved and free, were very interested in photography. And so I actually have a whole chapter in my book about how enslaved people were able to get their own photographs and use those in a variety of ways, and I talk about, and I'd be happy to talk about this more, especially to maintain social ties amidst the social disruptions of slavery. So they're very interested in photography in general, African Americans, both enslaved and free, but I couldn't really tell you what that dynamic was like when a slaveholder brought an enslaved person to the studio.
Indeed, a portrait has the participants staring into the lens. So can you speak to what it is about a photograph that humanizes people?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think it kind of gets at, you know, the ways in which we, you know, Americans, certainly for the longest time, have talked about photography being objective, being a kind of transparent lens onto the world. So people, you know, from the 1840s onwards, talk about when they see a photograph of a loved one, how they feel like they're looking right at the person. So I think there's something to that. I will add that I don't know that photography necessarily works to humanize subjects. One of the things I talk about with these photographs of enslaved people produced by slaveholders are the ways in which slaveholders both wanted photographs that would show the supposed benevolence of slavery. So in these photographs, the enslaved people are well-dressed. They're posing with a lot of the conventions that a free white person would pose with. There's oftentimes a small circular table that they're resting their arm on. They might hold different kind of props that suggest their personalities. There's one enslaved woman named Mama Molly who is holding a walking stick in her picture. Those are the sorts of things that everyone did with early photography. But the interesting thing for these photographs is then you don't see enslaved people posing in other ways. So free white women often pose with books, which were signs of literacy and intellect, and you don't see, from what I found in my research, enslaved people posing with books. You don't see enslaved people standing by themselves, which is a sign of stature in early photography. So in other words, there are certain ways in which slaveholders are placing limits on photography as a form of self-expression for enslaved people.
He is Professor Matthew Fox-Amato. His book is Exposing Slavery. I should note that we'll have some of the images from this fascinating book on our website, and that is BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Professor Fox-Amato, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
After this break, a trip to Gorgosa National Park. I'm George Prentice, and this is Idaho Matters.